Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Fair Data Podcast, where we discuss all things FAIR, making data findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. I'm Rory McNeil, host of the Fair Data Podcast, and my guest today is Lawrence Horton, who is currently working from the University of Glasgow at the DCC as a research data specialist. Lawrence, welcome. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So let's jump in at the deep end and start with what you're focusing on just now. Tell us about your current projects at the DCC.
Okay, so I've been at the DCC for just over a year now, and initial part of that was finishing up some of the FAIR project work. But since the end of this summer, we've started two big new consortia projects that we're involved in, and the first of those is called FAIR Impact. And FAIR Impact is designed to enable implementation of FAIR principles for European Open Science Cloud across different scientific research communities and research outputs at a European level, but also focusing on countries within Europe and also institutional level within Europe. So that has a number of work packages, a couple that I'm involved with in that project are engaging the support and adoption of data service providers, so repositories, also working on PID policies and support at a European level as well, and also kind of looking at trusted data repository support and building verification into that, and some of the metrics on research software as well as sort of aspects of communication within that, and calls for funding support. So hopefully those will be out soon. The other big project I'm involved in as well at DCC is called Skills for EOSC. And that is focusing on more on the sort of the training and support side of building up skills for FAIR datification in the European Open Science Cloud. And my involvement there is working on building a community support guide for establishing community supports on different areas of open science within research. So that's something that we just sort of started, and that I can't really say too much about that because I don't know which direction those communities are going to go in, what we're going to focus on. But the idea will to be build support resources to help people get started with communities in open science. So that's pretty much most of my time at DCC. I help out a bit as well with some of the work on the IJDC, the journal, and the conference as well, the Digital Creation Conference. But most of my time is spent on those training projects.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm trying to take my mind back to last week at the FAIR Digital Objects Conference, and I think there might have been an EOSC FAIR Impact poster, and maybe some people there as well. That's really interesting, and all this stuff is really topical. So I think we'll come back to actually several of those points later in the discussion. But we're going backwards in history today. So prior to the DCC, you were at the University of Toronto getting an MSc and also working in the library. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a Master of Information is the formal degree. Not sure what the difference is there, but it's an ALA accredited degree, which means I could apply for jobs in Canadian libraries from the data side. That's usually the first hurdle, and that's not something I had. I didn't have any sort of formal training in information management, if you like. It's something I sort of fell into and picked up a bit along the way, but coming to Canada in 2018, I realized that I needed that qualification, but I also felt that I'd missed quite a bit in terms of grounding in theory and some of the kind of essential readings and also sort of thinking critically about what I was doing in the past and kind of what people are doing now. So that was kind of a great opportunity to do that, and I really enjoyed studying for that degree. And while I was there, I was a student assistant with Scholars Portal, which is sort of the one of the broader infrastructure projects
in Canada. It's primarily based in Ontario, but there are sort of wider involvements through things like the Dataverse there. So that's one of the things I worked on. It was Scholars Portal Dataverse, but now it's been rebranded as Borealis Dataverse. And that is a Dataverse that Canadian universities can join as a consortium and host their own Dataverses in there. And that sort of the technical side and updates and so on is managed by Scholars Portal. So that was interesting as well there. And also working a bit on GIS data and metadata is something new for me there as well. So yeah, it was quite a positive experience.
Excellent. Yeah, again, let's come back to some of those points because I'd like to pick up on them. But in the meantime, let's continue working backwards here. So before Toronto, you were at the LSC, and then prior to that at the Leibniz Institute for the Social Sciences, I think working as a librarian and data manager. So you left the LSC in 2018, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that it's really been really over the past 4 years or so since you left that the data revolution in its various ramifications and formats has really gathered pace. So reflecting back on since you left the LSE, what do you think of some of the main developments that you've noticed during that time?
Yeah, I did leave there in 2018, and we were sort of beginning to see the end of perhaps a first wave and sort of the start of a second wave. That first wave was the reason I got the job back in 2014 when I first went there, was to really ensure that UK universities were compliant with the EPSRC expectations on research data management, which basically were the EPSRC saying, you universities are responsible for supporting researchers and preserving data. And if you're not, then we're not going to fund projects. So that created some consternation amongst universities that had EPSRC funding, primarily sort of on a status and reputational base. But that meant there was a sort of a lot of jobs going in the UK at that time on research data support. And my initial sort of role there was to establish a research data support facility within the library, working with sort of existing areas of support within the institution on, you know, data protection, research ethics, research awards, information security, all those kind of things, and the repositories that were there. So that was sort of the initial thing, and that was, you know, just making sure we were supporting researchers, finding somewhere to preserve data if need be, and helping with data management plans. And as I was coming towards the end of my time there, we started seeing more discussion about FAIR and open science. So there were a couple of sort of community initiatives or departmental or researcher initiatives around establishing open science practices, depending on departments. But there was also, I was also sort of seeing more and more at conferences and professional networks talk of FAIR. This was sort of, well, yeah, 2016, 2018, when the FAIR principles were sort of first published and established as well. So we started seeing a bit more of that. The other development sort of outside that is the increasing number of mandates that are appearing. So the UK, we were kind of well established on that in the early sort of 2000, 2010, and the EPSRC expectations were in 2015. So we'd sort of, as a country, we'd been sort of the forefront of that. But we're also sort of seeing now, you know, major work in the United States with the NIH expectations to come in next year. And also in my time here in Canada as well, the tri-agencies, sort of main funders here, have published a research data policy as well, which, you know, is coming into effect again next year. So I'm seeing sort of a lot of activity around establishing research data support again, and research policies and roadmaps and principles as well. So I think sort of people are catching up there in other countries. A couple of other things as well, I think towards the end of my time there as well, was sort of increasing pressure for support on text and data mining, particularly on obtaining access to text and data without sort of getting cut off or getting into trouble or legal obstacles. And that's something I think is quite significant as well in terms of sort of challenge to copyright, or, well, an accommodation of copyright, to allow researchers to do that. And also, sort of big data and high performance computing services as well, and how they're sort of coming into the library world in terms of support and researcher expectations on accessing and managing data to do that. So yeah, that's just a couple of sort of developments that come to mind in response to that question.
That's actually really, really interesting, because it's actually a fairly broad set of developments, each of which is happening in its own right. But then, as you say, they're not necessarily coming together, but they're happening in parallel, and there are crosses. And then people like yourself are aware of the various developments, and so they will be coming together. So that's actually really interesting. So I know that one of the things you've been working on for a while is PIDS, and you just mentioned your current involvement in the PIDS and in EOSC, and that's certainly an area that's really coming into its own now. So tell us a bit about what you've done with PIDS in the past, and I'm interested to hear more about the current project that you're working on as well.
Yeah, so I started really getting involved with PIDs or PIDs, as I sort of call them. I don't know why, but I do. That was primarily through, through the EPSRC expectations when I was at LSE, that data should be have a stable citation. This was pre-FAIR, you know, so... But it's one of the FAIR principles, obviously, now. So we had handles in our repositories at LSE, was the service there, but we weren't sort of using it as a data repository. It was just sort of an option in case there wasn't an alternative place for a researcher to put a particular data set. But I was, noticing that there was a requirement from some funders specifically for DOIs as a a form of PID. So one of the things I managed to get established there was that we could join the DataCite Consortium in the UK and create DOIs for objects in the research repositories there. And that was kind of interesting, because I really sort of got into looking closely at the DataCite metadata, and sort of walking that across from ePrint's metadata on the repositories there, you know, what the fields would be. But also thinking, you know, like going through the metadata schema sort of line by line or property by property, just thinking about what they actually mean and how that relates to different types of research data and different types of research outputs and so on. And that was quite an interesting, engaging process, and how that relates to other metadata standards and, you know, harmonizing and crosswalking across them. So that was one thing I did at DOI. When I left to come to Canada, I had kind of a period before I started my degree, and I worked with CESDA, the Consortium European Social Science Data Archives, through GESIS in Germany, working on a DOI policy with the colleague Gasis on what the CESDA expectations were around PIDs. So they had a limited set of options for particular types of PID, and also sort of guidance on how to apply them and so on as well there. So that was kind of an interesting refresher there. And yeah, then we come on back to the FAIR impact work on DOIs, particularly the element I'm involved in here. And again, it's only just started, so I can't say too much about it, but a focus not so much on research data, but on sort of research outputs around data. So I think one of the focuses there will be on software, so PIDs for software. In the ES policy, projects as well, there'll be work on PID or PID policy alignment across European Open Science Cloud, and again support for establishing PID services. And again, that's something else I'm sort of seeing in other countries as well. So I think in Canada there's similar work underway there. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, parallel paths as to where they're sort of going on that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting area, and also the growth of data site as a as a central player, and for example with the incorporation of IGSNs, or the transformation and incorporation of IGSNs into the data site universe.
Yeah.
But at the same time, other PIDs concepts and providers coming into their own, like, and some of those are quite grassroots, like the PID Inst group, which is primarily in Germany looking at PIDs for instruments, or RAID, which is the event-based or project-based PIDs, which is being driven out of Australia. So it's like I can't at least get a handle. There's so much going on, but it's very interesting. And then the whole issue of how do you incorporate PIDs in infrastructures, because they don't exist in a vacuum. There's just, I don't know, it's fascinating. I think it's just a lot of stuff going on, which is really interesting.
It is, yeah. Yeah. I sort of got into, my initial focus was on research data, but like you've been suggesting that there are PIDs for everything. awards, institutions, conferences, whole thing. And one of the sort of the future challenges or sort of additional challenges that is sort of linking it all together, ORCID's linked to DOIs, they link to publications and data sets and conferences, or awards and institutions and all that, and linking it all together. It's it's way beyond sort of my technical capability, all that, or ability to think sort of technically, but it is interesting to watch.
Yeah. So another area of interest, which you again have been involved in the past, is repositories. So I think it's fair to say that the repository world has a little bit longer history and is a bit more mature than the PID world. I wouldn't mind if you'd tell us a bit about, I'm interested in Dataverse as an example, and you mentioned Scholars Portal and Dataverse in Canada. So it'd be interesting, especially for people who might not know, to kind of get the, to me, it's interesting that Dataverse is being provided or made available at a national multi-institutional level. So that's kind of interesting if you'd tell us a bit about that. And then more generally, another thing which is interesting to me anyway, is you've got Dataverse, Zenodo, Figshare, Dryad, you've got a few popular general repositories, and I guess how are they, they're all trying to distinguish themselves in various ways, and they all have their own characteristics, but do you see any developments in the kind of high level looking down in the landscape?
It's kind of a fascinating world, really. Some of the social science data repositories are coming up to sort of 60th anniversaries. IPCSR and UK Data Service and GACES were all sort of established late 50s, early 1960s. So in some ways, they're not new. Obviously, they weren't digital back then, but a lot of the sort of the concepts around archives are pretty stable, in that sense. But the big difference is sort of, I think one of the things I noticed in the last couple of years is the rise of the generalist repository. Examples of which you have mentioned, and I was sitting in on something the other day, in association to the National Institute of Health initiative in the United States, or some of the initiatives going on there about the role of generalist repositories within that, as sort of places for data that doesn't quite fit in specialist data repositories, because disciplinary range or particular types of data, particular types of formats, and so on, and how they sort of play a role there. And that is one aspect of it. But the other interesting aspect as well is sort of the way that these sort of commercially backed repositories are getting into institutions as service providers. So institutions sort of buying in a Figshare repository and branding it as the university or whatever repository, but it's sort of built on Figshare infrastructure, for one. And Borealis in Canada was similar principle, but obviously that was built on or is built on Dataverse, which is sort of open source. So and that sort of a way is to provide the infrastructure perhaps for institutions that do not have the resources in time or money to be able to create, maintain and support a digital repository. So that's sort of an interesting and recent development, I think, in that area. I mean, I think disciplinary repositories do have a place because they do have the expertise and they often have the experience and the, well, I suppose, basically the metadata to be able to sort of capture subtleties and important aspects of particularly larger digital collections or data sets in a way that sort of generalist repository metadata wouldn't. So I think they will still have a place and there will still be an ICPSR and a UK data service and GACIS for years to come, hopefully. And another sort of area that I think is interesting in the development there is the sort of the rise of trusted digital repository status or certification of particular repositories that meet particular requirements in terms of their sustainability and their management of data and preservation of data as well. So, CoreTrust Seal, again, there was a bit of work done on that in the FAIRS FAIR program before I joined, but I caught some of the end of that, you know, providing support for repositories to meet CoreTrust Seal status, how FAIR data fits into CoreTrust Seal considerations or repository certification considerations is some work that's getting going on in some of these projects. That's sort of interesting to see, you know, and also I think is interesting whether some repositories need that or not. Sometimes the barriers are just not really worth trying to surmount. You know, if you're kind of doing a good job, you might not need to reach for that status. That's just sort of an interesting consideration. The other thing as well is sort of the we touched on it already, is sort of the links metadata. So how repositories are managing to incorporate PIDs in their various forms, you know, DOIs, ORCIDs, all those sort of different elements of research infrastructure and bringing them into records, particularly sort of publications. You know, I remember in the past that when I was at UK Data Service, you know, there would be a message on a catalogue record basically saying, if you use this data, please let us know and we'll add it to the record here, which of course no one ever did, you know. But these days, through sort of, you know, PIDs and those metrics, you can maybe sort of track that a bit better, whether data is being cited in articles or publications, and just bring that in, you know, a bit like ORCIDs do with DOIs now for your own sort of research records. The other thing as well is ease of use. Hopefully they are much easier to use. The archives I worked in, GACIS and UK Data Service, were mediated. So we would accept data from researchers and we would sort of process it, make sure they're giving us what they said they were giving us, check there are, you know, no issues with sensitivity, confidentiality, data protection, check that it all works, you know, as sort of no viruses or anything in there or all that, and then create a metadata record and upload it to the repository and make it available. But you're seeing, particularly with the generalist ones now, you're seeing sort of self-deposit, which hopefully kind of removes a barrier. There are challenges with that, of course, you know, whether researchers are confident or willing or able to sort of provide good metadata. And there, again, there are risks with there as well, about, you know, data sensitivity and third-party data ending up in some repositories. But hopefully that sort of ease of use sort of removes a barrier to using data repositories. And another sort of interesting element perhaps for repositories to deal with is dynamic data types and formats. So, data sets have been stable for so long, you know, when they go into a repository, it's a data set collected for a particular event and that's it. You know, it has sort of a fixed time period. and then it's in the archive, and there it sits. But how we deal with sort of dynamic data types that are not fixed, you know, constantly up changing and updating and so on, and how repositories handle that, you know, that's, again, perhaps going way beyond my sort of ability to comprehend. But that is an interesting discussion for sure. And same to a degree as well with formats as well, how we sort of deal with formats and the challenge of proprietary formats. You know, sometimes I think that challenge is a bit overstated by some people. you know, it's okay to use Word docs and Excel. It's not ideal, but it's okay. We can cope with that. But there are sort of other types of formats that may be problematic. You know, the whole thing around PDFs and so on is sort of a real challenge. And again, sort of, you know, unstable images, you know, dynamic formats. So yeah, again, it's just kind of some of the things that come to mind when sort of thinking about the challenge in repositories. It's an interesting world.
Well, that's I was going to pick up on some of the points you were mentioning, but it's fascinating. You had so many different things that we could spend the whole session talking about repositories. But I might come back to one thing later on. But it's the range of things you mentioned are all interesting. But also the fact that there is such a breadth is actually also an indication of what an active area that is. And then of course PIDs and repositories, how these things are coming together and crossing over as well. So yeah, so you've worked in research data, in the research data management field, and I guess in Germany and Canada and England and Scotland. I know this is kind of a big question, but do you have any reflections on some of the core commonalities or differences in these different geographies?
Yeah, just a couple of things, some of which I held back from the first question there. But in the UK, it was sort of interesting and great to see how the UK was sort of leading on a lot of this, really, particularly in terms of funder mandates and support for research data infrastructure and the research data management support through JISC at the time, you know, back in the 2010s, the early 2010s. That's how I sort of got involved in this area, was through those projects. And that was interesting to see, and just really sort of how the UK sort of went ahead and did that. And it's kind of the challenge now is sustaining and developing it. And how that's going to go, I don't know. But yeah, in Canada, sort of the big thing that's come through to me, and you know, I've seen this kind of in so many elements, you know, both doing a degree in information, but also sort of, you know, being involved a bit in the research data librarian communities here, is the question of Indigenous data sovereignty, and related to that, the development and purpose of the CARE data principles, CARE for collective benefit, authority to control, responsibility, and ethics. So FAIR is a data object focused set of principles, so focusing on the data itself. But CARE sort of brings in the rights of individuals and communities as to how that data is collected and used. So I think that's really important. And that's something that has been reflected in the Tri-Agencies Research Data Policy that was published last year, including language sort of built around Indigenous data sovereignty concerns, and how that is a consideration when it comes to data collection, data use, and data sharing. So that's kind of the big thing that's come from here. And I that is obviously applicable in Canada and other sort of colonized countries, but I think it has sort of general utility as well, sort of outside there. Our rights as individuals, how our data is collected and used, and in communities as well. Just thinking about Germany as well, the big thing that came through there was the emphasis and concern on privacy and data protection. Obviously, there's kind of good historical basis for that in Germany, but it was a very sort of sensitive and important issue, you know, that data protection and ensuring that people's rights and data protection rights were respected and acknowledged and preserved. So that was kind of the, one of the things that came from my experience in Germany. England and Scotland, I'm not so sure there's a huge difference there. Maybe that will sort of reveal itself in time.
Okay, interesting. One thing that I've become increasingly conscious of is the way in which national organizations play a role in RDM or don't, and how they interact with RDM infrastructure and services provided by institutions. So I'm going to ask you in a minute about how you see the DCC fitting into the European and UK landscape. But before we do that, let's come back to the other Canadian example you gave of Borealis and Dataverse. And let me ask a specific question, as well as asking you to comment generally. So you were saying that Borealis enables Dataverse to be set up, as if I understood it correctly, at institutions which might not have the interest or the resources or the wherewithal to run their own repository. Is Dataverse also available as an option to say bigger institutions that do want to organize it? And how does that all play out in practice?
Yeah, I mean, U of T, University of Toronto has a Dataverse. The big universities, I think, are all members, or certainly were two or three years ago when I was there. Yeah, so they are part of it, and it's basically that each Dataverse sort of has a manager at an institutional level, a data librarian or equivalent there, at an institutional representative, and but sort of the back end type stuff, you know, updating the Dataverse, I think it updates twice a year, and feeding those updates through to the Scholars Portal or Borealis installation would be done by Scholars Portal.
Okay. And more generally, and again, before we turn to the DCC in Canada, how is there, is that model of having a particular resource, in this case, Dataverse, hosted and supported by a pan institutional organization, Borealis, is that model, is it either being applied to, or do you think it will be applied to the provision of other kinds of research data management resources in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of research data management on a national level, the activity on there is now part of what's known as the Alliance, which is sort of a large infrastructure activity body, and there, the research data management groups in there have moved over to the Alliance now. So there are different elements in there aspects of research data management. So, you know, support on developing research data policies and roadmaps, support on dealing with sensitive research data, research expertise, and so on. And all these sort of elements are done through the Alliance. I mean, the work that's sort of done is by librarians at institutions, so it is sort of, you know, voluntary, but there are coordinators at the Alliance level to help with that. So that's kind of one of the things that's going on there. I mean, Canada is not a big country in terms of population, so that's probably a bit more manageable than, what, say, at the UK level, where there were sort of 90 plus universities or whatever. So maybe kind of some of these geographical, territorial, structural things come in. In Germany, I remember the federal system was a complicating factor, you know, different universities and their land or provinces had sort of different ideas about how to fund and manage universities there. So those are sort of things to take into account as well when it comes to that. But I think it is kind of interesting and good that a lot of, I suppose you could say, call it sort of community level work, is done by people actually involved in the day-to-day on research data management and FAIR data and so on, working together, talking to each other. There are various channels to do that, you know, the formal ones, but also kind of informal associations as well. Not so informal, but organizations like ISIS and RDAP, a couple I've been involved in. Again, allow networking and sharing of information, and also give you insights into what's going on in other countries that you may not have a direct link to as well. So,
okay. Yeah, interesting. So, and how about the, I actually, hopefully you could enlighten me as well as our listeners, but the DCC is always, I mean, it's right here in Edinburgh. I know lots of people that at the DCC have had probably hundreds of conversations over the years, but I'm still not entirely clued up on kind of what its mandate is and how, what its reach is. And is it a UK organization? Is it a multinational organization? Could tell us a bit about that.
Well, I wouldn't like to speak too authoritatively what its status is in regard to that, but like from my take on it and sort of having been around the DCC orbit for 12-13 years now, my sort of sense is that it has changed in its role. I mean, it's the Digital Curation Center, and initially, you know, the data lifecycle for managing research data, preserving research data and reuse of research data. And a lot of, I think, its initial work in that sort of first wave was involved with the JISC managing research data projects as well, providing support and advice for institutions to set up data management services and write data management policies. And they were actually involved with us at LSE when I was there doing that. But I think that has changed now. There's still sort of an element of that, and I know there is still some sort of trainings going on at institutional level within the DCC, but most of the focus, and certainly in my job, and I think some of my colleagues, is working on these large-scale, cross-national infrastructure projects. FAIR, Impact, Skills for EOSC, FAIR's FAIR before that as well. So, you know, working in consortiums with large range of European institutions, repositories, bodies, organizations as well, you know, like data site involved in some of these, working with those and being part of the projects there. I mean, again, it's kind of a personal view, there is a challenge there thanks to Brexit and the UK status as a member of Horizon Europe, and the ambiguity around that, or if there is ambiguity, and the challenges of being involved in that. I know there were some hurdles to overcome to be actually involved in some of these projects, FAIR Impact, for one, you know, whether we can actually be involved in it. So I think that is a real challenge, and that's unfortunately sort of out of our control. But hopefully there will be a way for us to sort of maintain a presence there.
Yeah, good. So last week I attended the first international conference on FAIR Digital Objects in Leiden, as I mentioned, and my mind is still spinning from the unbelievably rich kind of sea of ideas and concepts that were being discussed there. And many of them were actually very technical and specific. These are ideas that are growing up around FAIR and were presented and discussed at the conference. And that really brought home to me that FAIR means different things to different people in a big way. So I'm curious, what are your views on how FAIR should be implemented and where the focus should lie in terms of progressing verification of data? Another big question, a tough one, but...
No, it is. And, you know, the longer I'm sort of involved in this area, the more difficult I find it. the infinite possibilities of the beginner have long since gone, and there's so much I feel I don't know and couldn't answer, or, you know, would find, I'm finding a real sort of challenge. And FAIR is, you know, an element of that, because findable, accessible, interoperable, reusable sounds simple, doesn't it, on that level. But when you sort of dive down into it, what that actually means, how you sort of conceptualize and operationalize that is sometimes a real, you know, it's difficult, and DCC and some of the projects that, that they're involved in have worked on that. And Fares Fair had some publications on that, which I wasn't involved in, but I have read up on. And it's really sort of interesting what we mean. I mean, some things are nice and specific, so findable with a persistent identifier. Well, that's okay. We can sort of do that. But reusable, then we're getting into, well, reusable to who and how, and does reusable mean you just are able to pull it down and start working with it, or if you've got to do work to it, which you very often have to do, and I don't mean that as a criticism of data that's deposited by researchers. It's just that we all have different needs from data, different emphases, different questions, different focuses on to do a little bit of cleaning and so on. Is that a challenge to reuse? Does that mean data is not reusable? Or to what extent does reuse become impossible when there are other challenges as well? Protection and privacy as well. I mean, I kind of had a concern in the back of my mind about, when we're saying data is anonymized or pseudo-anonymized, how confident can we be that that's the case, when it comes to making data available and reusable without sort of adequate protections, as processing power and big data rise and rise, the barriers to identifying individuals within data sets may be falling in ways we're not realizing. I mean, there are people doing much more sophisticated and engaged work on that than I'm doing, just sort of thinking and talking about it at the top of my head. But it is a concern that I have about reuse. And accessible as well. I think copyright is a real challenge. And the questions around, whether data has intellectual property, and whether how that varies between territories and legal systems, and levels of that, and what that also means in terms of what that means in terms of sort of like reusing data, whether you're actually using it in a way that violates copyright. If you're doing text and data mining, is a particularly interesting one in that. I mean, the UK has an exception in law for that, but there's sort of problems within that as well, around how publishers can sometimes use data security or systems protection clauses to shut down access to that. So yeah, there's sort of all things going on around the FAIR things. I mean, one thing I did want to mention in relation to that is the CARE principles again. And, one thing I'm sort of trying to do in my own work on around FAIR is try and bring in FAIR and CARE as sort of equal concepts. I mean, they're not competing concepts. They weren't designed to be competing concepts. They were designed to be complementary. But trying to sort of, bring in that issue of data sovereignty to considerations about data collection and data reuse. And that's not just sort of focused on individuals themselves or communities themselves, but also about the lands and territories in which data is sometimes collected as well, and how that has been abused in the past. So thinking about those things around FAIR as well, our responsibility as researchers and reusers, and bringing in the ability for people to control how their data are used now, but also in the future as well. And the idea of sort of, collective benefits and important that research should benefit those communities and not harm them, basically. So I'm sort of trying to see how people are bringing that in to discussions on FAIR. Say, this is something I picked up much more in North America or in Canada than I've seen in Europe, but hopefully that it is sort of getting through as a concern. And the CARE principles obviously came after the FAIR ones, but hopefully that sort of awareness is building there. So that's got some of the things around FAIR that I think from my own interests are going on. And some of the other things we've already mentioned about stable objects and dynamic data and so on are also part of that. We've already sort of talked about those. So.
Okay, well, thanks. Yeah, I think your FAIR and CARE point is a great one to wind up on, because it's something that you're interested in. It's also particularly relevant to Canada. Just on that point, and an encouraging note, perhaps, My trip to Leiden last week was actually my second trip to the Netherlands in the last 2 months. And the first one was for the Open Science Festival in late August. And at the Open Science Festival, five prizes were given out for research projects which had an open science element to them. And at least two of them, and I think possibly three, I know at least three, and maybe in some ways all five of the winners, the CARE principles were core, were central to the way in which the projects were done. There's in terms of involving communities, in one example, it was actually historical research relating to slave records in Suriname. In the other case, it was a mental health project in Holland. But in both cases, the CARE principles were more than front and center. They were really driving the whole design and implementation of the project. So and there's both of those examples are coming out of research, which was ultimately designed in Netherlands. So I guess these things are actually expanding out from places like Canada and Australia. Yeah. So interesting. I mean, but
there's a lot of work done in the archives community on marginalized voices or silenced voices, you know, gaps in records or groups that were deliberately sort of excluded from archives, you know, particularly when archives sort of had a more government focus, and trying to bring in those voices, you know, where they can, but also community archive groups as well, sort of built outside of traditional networks of archives. There's kind of a lot of literature on that that I was reading during my degree that I think sort of has applicability, and also kind of, you know, our roles as data librarians or research support, whether we should be more involved in our communities in terms of where we can to help support that. That's great to hear. I mean, just I didn't get the chance to shoehorn this in, but kind of one of my big bugbears with FAIR data is it's sometimes framed as equivalence to open data, and or it's sometimes built as an open data concept, which it is, of course, but and all open data is shareable, of course, but not all shareable data is open or should be open. And I'm conscious of not framing FAIR as an exclusively open standard or open practice. So, just wanted to kind of shoehorn that in just at the end there.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, well, listen, Lawrence, thank you so much for this stimulating conversation. And that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. The FAIR Data Podcast is provided by fairdatapodcast.org and produced by Mehroz Ahmed. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter at FAIR Data Podcast. New episodes are released every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. UK, 5 p.m. Central European Time, and late in Asia Pacific. See you then.